There is no health without mental health. Join Brian Green for Mental Wealth on 103.2 Dublin City FM each Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. Your Mental Health Awareness Station on 103.2 Dublin City FM with Brian Green.
103.2 Dublin City FM. This is Mental Wealth with Brian Green. If you want to get in touch with the programme, email us mentalwealth@dublincityfm.ie. On today's programme, coming up in about 15 minutes' time, I'll be talking with Alcohol Action Ireland about binge drinking. Yes, the weekend of St. Patrick's and all that. But first, I go to a story that one of our researchers kind of led us onto, and it is that there's a radio station in Ireland. I think it's the third oldest station after 2FM and Radio 1, and it's on the air about 37 years, and it's operating as a hospital radio station from St. Eta's in Portrane, and its manager is on the line, Tom Nochter. How are you doing?
How are you, Brian? Nice to talk to you.
Tell us a bit about your radio station in Portrane.
Well, the radio station here started in 1984 in around there as a part of radio, believe it or not, even though it was a HSE.
Weren't we all back then?
We've been on air ever since, with one small break around 94 we went off. We were the first station to receive a license. We're the first license station. I don't even think RTE or 2FM actually had a physical license. Obviously they were the government run station, so I think we're the first station to receive a license, and we received that in the form of a dispensation to remain on air. As you know, anyone involved in radio will know, when the local licenses were being issued in 1987, part of the deal to get a license for existing stations was that they had to go off air
on the 31st of December. Yeah,
so we got a dispensation from the then Minister for Communication, who gave us a letter allowing us to remain on air while we applied for our licence. So that is, to our mind, technically, that is the first licence that was ever issued.
Brilliant.
I've seen that document myself in many, many moons ago. It's probably long gone now, but I did see it when I came here in 1994 into the radio station. I was working in the hospital beforehand, and a vacancy came up here in the station. I had a history with pirate radio, as a lot of us youngsters did, and someone here, one of the managers here, found out and asked me would I come on board and help present a bit. So I did that for a short while, and then the manager's vacancy came up, and I applied for that and was successful. So this has been my job. This is my job to run the radio station here at St. Edith since 1994 until now, 25 years here this year, I think, in the radio station.
That dispensation would have been offered to you because you were coming from the campus of St. Edith's Portrane, and it was one of the country's largest mental health institutions. You had a listenership who needed the radio.
That's right. We had a listenership here who, we had a huge listenership, or a huge amount of residents at that time who would have been up in, heading towards the thousands, I'd imagine. And we were given dispensation because the clients loved it so much. They loved their music. They used to be able to ring in here and get their requests played, and they still can, of course. And that dispensation was applied for. The management here applied for it with the manager of the radio station at the time, applied with the minister, and he saw fit to allow us to continue. So that's how that happened, yeah.
And so what kind of numbers did you have back then, and how many would you have now?
Oh, we had on the campus back then, it would have been, I'd say there'd be maybe more than 1,000 people back then. Not 100% sure. I only came on to the hospital here in 89, and there was probably more than 1,000 here at that stage. But in 83, 84, when it came on, there would have been even more, because Cairn, the community, was only sort of starting off then. Now on the campus here, I think there'd be only 200 or 300 on the campus, if there would even be that. There's no psychiatric unit on the grounds here at St. Edith's anymore. It's all people with learning disabilities. Of course, they are building the new mental health hospital, or the Dundrum, the replacement for Dundrum, here on the grounds at the minute. I think that's to open 2021 or something like that. It's going well. You can see it just as you're driving up the avenue to the right, and it seems to be going up at a pace.
More listeners for St. Edith's Radio. You're on 89.5 on the FM. You stream online, and your programming is to entertain the campus and your listeners abroad and around the country as well.
Yeah, it's we're broadcasting on 89.5 FM on low power, reasonably low power. I think it's 10 watts or something like that. We're licensed for, so that doesn't get very, very far. You can hear it in Swords if you really want to.
Baldoyle, if you're like me.
Yeah, if you're on the coast. Of course, we're lucky on the coast, and FM signal is line of sight. So up and down the coast, you get it further. But once you start heading inland, it disappears quite quickly. Be crackly in that. So you'd really want to listen to it when you compared it to the likes of the quality of the audio around us. Once you get inland, we'd be going off, getting a bit weaker. So, but we're also streaming online, and the reason we did that was we had a lot of, I mentioned care in the community, and we have a lot of people who moved out of here, out into houses in Howth, Malahide, Rush, Lusk, Ballybuckle, places like that. There's houses that are attached to St. Edith's campus, and our FM signal wouldn't have been strong enough to get to those. So what we did was we started to stream. So any of those houses have the facility to listen to us on phones now, of course. It's all phones or into computers, anything with internet radios or whatever. So it means the people moving out of here don't lose the link with their friends. As I mentioned earlier, they'd be playing requests for one another and stuff like that, birthdays and whatever. So they still can have that link out in the community. A plus side of that is that when you're streaming on the internet, you can be heard anywhere in the world. And we have over 1,000 people who actually follow our stream, like it on the TuneIn app. And we have, I looked at the logs there recently, and it was something like we'd had 800 listeners in that month over 87 different countries.
Wow.
Blew me away.
Yeah. Are you a station that encourages service users, or we used to call them patients,
yes,
to access the station? Like, do you take them on air at all?
We have 3 service users, not all of this service, but 3 who are with classes, people, service users who are actually on air presenting a show. We've one on there at the minute. We have Jack Stereo Jack, who was world famous. Everyone knows Stereo Jack, and Jack was a service user here back in the 80s and early 90s, and he's actually second. He actually helps me run the place here on a voluntary capacity. He comes in and opens up and looks after the other presenters and that. And we have a chap who travels up from Gorey. He's a service user down in Gorey, and comes up on the train twice a week, actually, and presents a show and goes off home again afterwards. So, yeah, we're certainly anyone from any service that would be interested. Like, it's very therapeutic, broadcasting and music in general, of course. So anyone, we would certainly have a leaning towards training those people in if they had an interest in and made themselves known to us. We've always had service users involved in the presenting on air side. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. Tom Nocters, who we're talking to, he's manager of St. Edith's Hospital Radio. And Tom, can you tell me, like, you just mentioned something there, the power of radio to heal, to be involved in it and take part and be in a team, that must give people huge confidence boost.
It does, of course, and there was a study, a hospital radio, there's 3 left, 3 hospital radio stations left in Ireland. There's ourselves, there's Cork University Hospital in Cork, obviously, and there's South Tipperary General Hospital in Clonmel. We did have the Mater, Beaumont, and Limerick. There's one in Limerick. They've all since closed down, unfortunately, Limerick only recently. But it's big in the UK. There's a huge hospital radio body in the UK, and they have the Hospital Broadcasting Authority, which is its overseeing body. And they did a study last year on the benefits of hospital radio to patient care and recovery. It was more of a general hospital than ourselves, which is a residential unit. But the findings of that study are online, and it's very beneficial, very, 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 very therapeutic for people in hospital to have access to the music they want to hear when they want to hear it, and also to know what's going on around. And it sort of eases the stress of being in hospital.
Tom Nochter of St. Eta's Hospital Radio, 89.5 FM if you're in the Portrand Donabate area. Coming up a little later in the programme, I'll be talking to an ambassador from the Irish Cancer Society. Their Daffodil Day is this Friday. But first, I'm talking next with Ewan McKinney, Head of Communications with Alcohol Action Ireland. A lot of stories in the news about binge drinking, so I thought we'd discuss this on air today. Good afternoon, Ewan.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
We're just after the weekend that is our national holiday, St. Patrick's, and there is a lot of alcohol consumed and a lot of enjoyment had, but some people will be taking it to extremes and have had incidents of binge drinking over the weekend and possibly in their life as well. How prevalent is binge drinking in Ireland?
Well, I suppose we have to look at the whole cohort of population. I suppose that if we start from the top, and we have about a population of 75% of people who actually drink in Ireland, and of those sort of cohort, about 54% of them have a harmful relationship with alcohol. So, you know, we have a problem at that level. But in the cohort that is 18 to 24 year olds, we know that there's around a 20% prevalence of binge drinking. But overall, it's around 36-37% of the population would have a weekly episode in relation to binge drinking.
That sounds really high.
Yeah, it is pretty high. And at the cohort at the 18 to 24 year olds, it certainly is Europe's highest. We're the highest in Europe in that respect. And the most recent studies that have been published in the Lancet there recently would indicate that, you know, at a tragic level, you know, children at the ages of 15 to 19 would also be sort of leading the way in relation to some of the European countries.
Is there much of a difference between girls and boys at this age, or should we be looking at that?
Not really. I mean, the data statistically is around the same, so it hovers in around 60% both for males and females. And that data is reflected of, you know, there's a couple of school studies that are done on a every 4 year basis, and they would indicate that kids around that age, or, you know, 60% of them would have had experience with alcohol at that point. Now, it's, you know, when it becomes a more significant problem, especially in the context of drunkenness, that data, the number starts to fall towards 30-35%, and then drunkenness in the most immediate sense, you're talking about 14%. So it's a complex enough landscape in relation to just, you know, the difference between experience in alcohol, beginning to drink, and then binge drinking. So binge drinking is obviously a significantly more worrying trend.
Now, obviously, there's, you know, no shows to work, and business will suffer from this, but I'm more interested in possibly the individuals. Are they storing up kind of physical and mental health problems for the future with their actions of today?
But there undoubtedly are, and especially if people start to drink at a very young age, there's, you know, proven data which demonstrates that you will drink more as you develop into adulthood, and their health outcomes are greatly diminished by virtue of the fact that early commencement with alcohol. But to go back to your earlier point, I mean, the harms to others is actually, as you know, we do tend to all the time focus quite a bit on the individual drinker and the harm to them, and that's obviously crucially important, because they are the ones that are, I suppose, essentially attributing the greater level of cost to society, both at a health, public health expenditure level, but the harms to others is also very significant. And, you know, we have 200,000 children today living in families where parental alcohol misuse is a significant factor. And we know that 1 in 7 workers tend to go to work every day and are, you know, have obstacles placed in front of them in relation to doing their work effectively and efficiently, because somebody maybe hasn't turned up, or whoever has turned up isn't in a fit condition to work.
When you say 200,000 children in situations where there's harmful drinking, is that measure changed over the years? Like, the BMI index has been shown to have been changed by scientists and doctors. Has the units of alcohol decreased, making more people come into that catchment?
Yeah, that's reasonable, but not on the level of alcohol misuse, which is largely on the basis of binge drinking to some degree. But yes, the units have fallen over a generation. They have certainly changed. But the 200,000 is really in relation to children who are living in houses where people have a harmful relationship with alcohol.
What public policies would you like to see kind of promoted to alleviate this kind of stress that is, you know, happening in families and in society?
Well, the principal measure that has been, you know, it took a very long time to get it on the statute books, which is the Public Health Alcohol Act, which was passed late last year. And it has a number of crucial policy instruments included in that, which are essentially the main principal aspects of the WHO sort of global strategy to reduce alcohol consumption and alcohol harms. And that act took 3 years of process through the Oireachtas to get enacted. So there are significant elements in that piece of legislation, like minimum unit pricing, the content of advertising, labelling of products, structural separation within stores, all of these measures, a lot of which have not been commenced. And so whilst they remain to be the law of the land, they haven't actually been commenced by the Minister for Health. And we would be of a view to urge the Minister to proceed with these measures as quickly as possible.
And would the advertising one have been implemented yet? Because we obviously had seen the Six Nations being sponsored by Guinness for the last 8 weeks, and you know, sport and advertising are still linked to alcohol in a big way.
Yeah, well, the content of advertising would significantly change the landscape in the relation that how alcohol is promoted, but that measure has no sense yet as to when that will be commenced.
Okay, just about your organisation, Alcohol Action Ireland, are you like a counterbalance to the drinks industry and DrinkAware?
Very much so. We're an independent voice that provides expert policy review and insight into how to bring about this level of alcohol consumption reduction and then subsequently alcohol-related harm. So we've been the central advocacy voice in relation to bringing about this legislative change as it was designed. So we would be essentially, you're right, the weight against the alcohol industry and its surrogates like DrinkAware, who are, you know, essentially the voice of conditionalising the Irish culture in relation to alcohol.
And are yourselves and the other side in the industry evidence of lobbying works? That, you know, if you spend enough hours and years, you know, banging on about a new policy, that it'll effectively get to the politicians in the end?
Well, not really. I mean, in the sense that, you know, we're a very small voice in that respect. We don't have the resources that the alcohol industry have. And in fact, you know, in relation to the most recent battle around the Public Health Alcohol Bill, global alcohol industry targeted Ireland and lobbied against that. And that's a very, very significant level of resources. And you're talking about, you know, the top five alcohol companies in the world have a combined income of around $155 billion. So in that level, you know, when, like, some of the measures that were proposed had to be reviewed by the EU at various stages. And the global alcohol industry weighed in against us at those particular junctures. So we have a massive counter opponent against us. So it's very much a David and Goliath battle.
While we see that you do the lobbying stuff, is there organisations that you recommend where people should go to if they feel that they are, you know, drinking too much, or they know of people who might need to drink a little less?
Yeah, well, the state have a public service, essentially an alcohol advisory site, askaboutalcohol.ie, and there's a very good set of information in relation to, you know, if you're concerned about your drinking or if you're concerned about others drinking. They also have a set of measures in relation to calculating what it is you have been drinking and what it is you do drink in relation to the standard drinks. And they also have a very detailed set of resources in relation to the services that are available to people on a county basis.
Brilliant. Ask about alcohol.ie. And is there anything big on your calendar coming up in the near future that you'd like to promote while we have you on the radio?
Well, for the last, you know, earlier this year we launched a new initiative called Silent Voices, and that was in relation to our earlier discussion in relation to those 200,000 children. We feel that there's an absolutely acute need to recognise the developmental difficulties that these children are exposed to on a daily basis, because they become adults, and we know that in the past and over the last number of generations, Ireland will have produced a number of adult children who now have issues around their development over that period because of alcohol. And so we, you know, we talk about those people as people who have no voice and have not had a voice in this debate, and we're trying to advocate in relation to better awareness and better understanding of the conditions that have led their lives and shaped their lives.
Brilliant. Ewan McKinney, Head of Communications at Alcohol Action Ireland, many thanks for your time today.
Super. Thanks, Brian.
There is no health without mental health. This is Mental Wealth on 103.2 Dublin City FM with Brian Green.
This Friday is Daffodil Day, the Irish Cancer Society's annual flag day, and a really important day on their fundraising calendar. I'm joined by Sarah Murray. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
You're one of the ambassadors for the Cancer Society. You're one of their contacts and users. You've used them in the past.
I have, yeah. I've decided to be part of their campaign this year, just to raise awareness for the services that the Irish Cancer Society provide for cancer patients. Unfortunately, I was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 32. I was very young, and I didn't know what supports were out there. Luckily, I suppose I hadn't been touched too much by cancer in the past, so I hadn't had to use any services. When I was diagnosed, I felt quite alone. I suppose I was very young. Not many other people around me had been affected by cancer personally. And it was then throughout my treatment when I started to, I suppose, physically get unwell due to the treatment, and then that took a toll on my mental health.
Tell us about that. In what ways did it affect you?
So when I was first diagnosed, I thought I was a very strong person mentally. I was straight away into the thought process of how am I going to beat this? What can I do to help myself? So I went into the whole, like, keep my body as healthy as possible by eating healthily, etc., keeping up sports, keeping up exercising as much as I could. But as I got sicker and sicker with the chemotherapy, that all took a turn that I couldn't do anymore. So then when I was physically unable to do things, it took a very bad impact on my mental health. There were days, weeks, months of my life for over two to 2.5 years where I found it difficult to leave the house. I found it difficult to do day-to-day normal tasks. I had a young child. My daughter was only one when I was diagnosed. Like, looking after her was a chore. It wasn't anything I could enjoy. I suppose I 100% lost the love of life. I was severely depressed and suffered with extreme anxiety over my health and over my future.
It sounds like a terrible time. In what ways was the Cancer Society's services there to be availed of? What were you able to do with them?
So the more treatment I had, I was in and out of Beaumont Hospital every week, and the more it went on, I noticed on the way in there was a Daffodil Centre there at the Irish Cancer Society, and I used to read the booklets that were outside, and then every week I was going in for treatment, I'd stop and talk to the nurses that were in there and the volunteers. And just being able to talk to people who understood, I suppose, what I was going through, who knew about it. And a lot of the volunteers are actually survivors themselves. So to speak to people who personally had, had been through it was such a help. Towards the end of my treatment, when I was mentally very unwell, I learned of the cancer nurse line that the Irish Cancer Society provide. Unfortunately, at the beginning of my treatment, I didn't know about that. And I think that's my main thing at the minute, is to raise awareness about all these services, because I didn't know about them when I was first sick. And maybe if I did, I wouldn't have got as far down as I did. I used to just ring the cancer nurse helpline and be at home in my bed and have a chat. And, like, even just for people to understand, as I said, what I was going through, and for be able to just give me some little tips of how to get through a day and how to mentally think of the future, I suppose, and just understand was the main thing I needed, someone to understand what I was going through.
So when you hit a low moment, there's people you can ring and they'll understand the stages of treatment that you're going through and where you're at, because they do this all the time with lots of people, and they've got empathy for your situation, and they lift you from the place where you are into to a better place before the end of the call. Is that what happens?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, they're very positive, and not in a positive way that you think it's not normal. Like little things, just even little steps they would ask you to do. And if you did them, you know, it would feel better because you're hearing it from someone who knows what you're going through. People can be so nice outside of like friends, family, and try and help you. But when they don't know exactly how you're feeling, it's quite tough. Whereas the nurses and the volunteers on the nurse helpline do know what you're going through. As you said there, they deal with this every day. They're dealing with people of all ages, of all treatment plans, and they know it. So they're able to, lift you up before the end of the call. And they're always available to ring. So you can ring whenever, you can ring back an hour later if needed.
And the connection between this helpline and the other services from the society is that they're funded by their Daffodil Day, and that's on Friday. People will be out and about and they'll see people collecting and they give out a daffodil and you can put some money in the box. It's really important that people fund these kind of services, is it?
Well, all of the Irish Cancer Society's funding comes from fundraising. So Daffodil Day is the biggest fundraising event the Irish Cancer Society have every year. So on Daffodil Day, if you see any Irish Cancer Society volunteers out there, donate, buy a pin, just to help. It helps the services, the nurse line, the volunteer drivers, the end-of-life palliative care service, night nursing that the Irish Cancer Society provide. All of that comes from donations from the public.
It sounds like you've had a good experience with them. You're fine and healthy now?
I am, yeah. I'm good and healthy and, looking forward to every day.
Is there any one piece of advice you'd give people who might be going through something like that, who are listening to the radio now?
The one piece of advice I would always give, and I give to myself as well, is talk. Don't ever feel that you're alone, because you're not. There's so many people out there who want to help and who are able to help. So express how you're feeling and don't hold it all in and think that you'll be able to do it yourself, because you need help from other people outside.
Okay. And I think we have the number for the helpline. So if anybody needs any assistance, they can ring the nurse line, and it's 1-800-200-700. It's a free phone number and it's funded from the Daffodil Day through the Daffodil Centre. And Sarah Murray, thank you very much for your time today to explain this to us.
Thanks very much.
Sarah Murray, Ambassador with the Irish Cancer Society. Their flag day, Daffodil Day, is Friday. 103.2 Dublin City FM, Mental Wealth with Brian Green, and that's all we've time for today. My thanks to the production team, Joe, Pia and Margaret. We're back next Tuesday at 12:30. Join us then. Take care, stay safe and goodbye.